平安さながばちゅさがなぶなちゅさがぶやんからばばはいてじゃすりなばてたばすとまべるべしゃばはいShanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare
Okay, verses then 12 to 20, signs of victory. Srila Prabhupada comments on verse 12. The grandsire of the Kuru dynasty could understand the inner meaning of the heart of his grandson, Duryodhana, and out of his natural compassion for him, he tried to cheer him by blowing his conch shell very loudly, befitting his position as a lion.Indirectly, by the symbolism of the conch shell, he informed his depressed grandson, Duryodhana, that he had no chance of victory in the battle, because the Supreme Lord Krishna was on the other side. But still, it was his duty to conduct the fight, and no pains would be spared in that connection. So, by blowing the conch shell, then they blow the conch shells before the battle, right? So it has that element. But...Duryodhana is, you know, feeling anxiety. So to cheer him up, then he blows the conch shell so that it will, that Bhishma is committed, which he is. But at the same time, in a sense, he's just blowing alone. And that was his answer, because he could have also said some words or this and that, or, you know, given something to encourage the men. He just blew the conch shell, but the conch shell also then represents the Supreme Lord.So then he was saying, and the conscious victory. So he's establishing that the Lord will be victorious, and the Lord's on the other side. So, like that. But it's indirect. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna blew their divine conch shells, the sound shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. In verse 19, Sanjaya says, Sagosho Dhritarashtra Nam Hridayani Vyadarayata.That sound shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. Since Dhrita means captured and Rashtra means land, the statement can be translated as shattered the hearts of those who usurped the kingdom. Like that. This is the fun with Sanskrit. You can get so much more out of it than you would get in other languages. Like that. So then actually Dhritarashtra is the correct name.Because he's not supposed to be king, but he is. So he's usurped the position. Arjuna had Hanuman on his flag, a chariot given by Agni, and above all, Lord Krishna, who is the master of the senses and the husband of the goddess of fortune. Who is the master of the senses and the husband of the goddess of fortune, was personally present to guide him.In such auspicious conditions, arranged by the Lord for his eternal devotee, lay the signs of assured victory. Right, so you have Krishna is blowing his conch shell, then you have the Hanuman, it disturbed the enthusiasm of the enemy. He has a chariot given by Agni.On that chariot is the flag of Hanuman. Hanuman's a great devotee of the Lord. He's always victorious. You know, and he has Krishna himself, you know, who is the Supreme Lord and the husband of the goddess of fortune. So that means all prosperity, all glory will come. So all the signs are there for the Pandavas, right? And we don't see any signs for the...Dhritarashtras. right? The land usurpers, right? Although Krishna promised not to fight, he nevertheless accepted the Kauravas' challenge and blew his conch. The transcendental sound cheered the Pandava army and shocked the sons of Dhritarashtra. In the Bhagavad Gita 11:36, we find another example of how the presence of the Lord invokes opposite reactions. It's said that in the lower planets, in the hellish planets, that when the Lord blows his conch shell, then the wives of the demons, they have miscarriages. Right? So it's very powerful. So you know, the conch has that effect. So imagine that on the Kshatriyas, who are so powerful and all that. So, but, you know, they lose their enthusiasm, you know. And that's, you know, Krishna could blow it louder, but, you know, there is a limit to, because if he kills them all with his conch shell, then his devotees, there's no fun, and his devotees won't get the credit. Right? But otherwise, he could do that also. Arjuna said, okay, another example how the presence of the Lord invokes opposite reactions. Arjuna said, O master of the senses, the world becomes joyful upon hearing your name, and thus everyone becomes attracted to you, attached to you. Although the perfected beings offer you their respectful homage, the demons are afraid. They flee here and there. All this is rightly done. Now here Arjuna said this is rightly done. So if by chanting Hare Krishna, presenting Krishna consciousness in a nice way, you know, we're directly Krishna consciousness in a cultured, gentlemanly way. But it's bold. And then some people will become attracted and attached to Krishna. They'll take up the mission. And others will flee in different directions being afraid. That's correct. We shouldn't say, oh, they're fleeing, this is bad. Poor demons, they're running away because we're being Krishna conscious. That means then you think, then something mundane takes precedence. Right is established by something mundane. You understand this? No, it's rightly so means you always have this. To say that, no, everybody will like you is bogus. Because that person who thinks, tries to make everyone like them, factually speaking, no one likes them. Because to make everyone like you, then either you have to be God and you're so expert, or it's a matter of, on the material platform, then you have to be very shallow because you can't go very deep into anybody's life, otherwise you would take on those qualities. So therefore, there is nothing there of substance for anyone really to be friendly with. Does that make sense? So someone's a good devotee, everyone likes them. You know, or they're, you know, they don't have any motives and all this and that, then you might find, you know, a broader range. But there are some people who still won't like. Even Krishna, people didn't like him. Right? But how much, you know, Kamsa didn't like him. On the other side, how much did, you know, the Yadavas like him? Right? So that's what's going to happen. So this idea is, no, it'll all be this way. That's foolish. Energy never works like that. If there's positive, there's always negative. And if there's no negative, then there can be no positive. So that just means static. There's nothing happening. Right? And because the jiva technically is not, able to exist without interaction, then that means stagnant. Something will go wrong. Because spiritual is ever fresh. So you can only have stagnant in the material platform. So if you try to get a neutrality, it will be material. It won't be spiritual. Therefore, liberation, even though it's beyond the material world, is still counted within material consciousness. Right? It's beyond the modes, beyond karma, yes, but it's still within material consciousness. Because there is no such thing as for the jiva of just being situated spiritually and not devotionally. Krishna can do that, but the jivas can't. Right? And even Krishna is not inclined. Otherwise, why do you expand the creation? If sitting alone was great, why isn't he still doing that? Why are we here? Right? We're here because interaction's better. You understand? So we have to give up this idea that everything will be perfect everywhere, you know, all the things with the rainbows and the butterflies and, you know, people playing on their pan pipes and, you know, and all these kind of things like that. You know, it's not real. It doesn't exist, never has. Reality is you connect it to God, things become nice. You don't connect it to God, no matter how nice it is, it's extremely temporary. That's all. It's that simple. The demons cannot tolerate the presence of the Lord. The same truth applies on the adhyatmic level, where the holy name of Lord Krishna drives away the demon-like material desires from the devotee's heart. Right? So the holy name, then, if you chant and you're focused on it, because adhyatmic means yourself, the mind, it will drive away the demoniac mentality. Right? The devotional will become attracted, and the demoniac will run away. So, not bad. The Pandavas blew their conch shells immediately after Krishna sounded Panchajanya. This signifies that they were the Lord's dependent followers and acted on his behalf. On the other side, the Kauravas acted independently, pursuing their own selfish desires. Right? In other words, Krishna blew his conch shell, then the Pandavas blew theirs. So that was because they're dependent upon him. Right, but the Kauravas, Bhishma blew his conch shell, and then they blew theirs. But it's all just because that's what you do. It wasn't that they're dependent upon the Lord or dependent on Bhishma. They just independently blow theirs. Each one thinks I am the great warrior here. But the Pandavas aren't thinking I'm the great warrior. They're all thinking Krishna's special. Right, so it looks the same, but because of consciousness, it's very different. Right. This erroneous mentality was the ultimate reason for their defeat, as it is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 18:58. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. So, Krishna's point is you will cross over all the obstacles by his grace. Not by your intelligence, not by that neat book that you found on the shelf in the self-help section. You know, none of that. It's by Krishna's grace. So you make an endeavor, whatever that is, nice, but if it's not dependent upon Krishna, it will never be successful. Right? Otherwise, the greatest personalities, you know, where are they now? So powerful. Where are they? People have changed, you know, the history. Where are they? You know, who cares? You know, who cares? So this is the point, is that all obstacles, now Krishna doesn't say because you're connected to me, there'll be no obstacles. The material world means obstacles. But you'll be able to cross over them because you're connected to Krishna. We have the idea that because I'm connected to Krishna, now there'll be no obstacles. Then unfortunately, it's a misunderstanding because then we're taking Krishna consciousness and considering it karma. Right? Because by good karma, you get good situations. Right? So if I do practice Krishna consciousness, I should always be in good situations. Right? And if I'm not, something's wrong with the process. No, but you're able to cross over those obstacles by Krishna's grace. So by depending upon him, then we can cross. Right? And so if everything is going nice, that's by Krishna's grace. Because the material world never is like that. You know? We see everyone has problems. Even Brahma, he's the top of the universe. Still, he gets chased by, you know, demoniac sons and all kinds of things. Like, he has problems. Like that. You see everywhere. It's probably because that's the material world. It's like saying if you're going to go into the water but not get wet. You know, you're going to jump in the water, get the cooling effect, relaxation and recreation, but you won't get wet. Right? That's not going to happen. So being in the material world, there's no such thing as no obstacles. So if we're adjusted with that, then we'll find Krishna consciousness is very dynamic because we don't become bewildered because obstacles come up. And then it's like, well, what's wrong? No. Obstacles come up. That's just the way the material world. Now, how you can deal with them and how you can cross, that's where you see how much Krishna consciousness you're applying in your life. So if it becomes easy, you know, means easy meaning the focus is there and you're determined and therefore it doesn't mean it's not hard work, but it's not going to mentally disturb you much. So the more advanced, the less it will disturb you. Right? Does that make sense? So like that. The fact that the Pandavas did not sound their conscience first shows that they would prefer to settle the conflict by conciliation. That's also because Krishna is a charioteer, right? So the first one to blow the conch should be Yudhishthira, right? And then others will blow. Just like on the other side, Bhishma blows, then everybody blows, right? So the leader, the commander, you know, or at least, okay, Satyaki, he was the commander of the army, then he would blow, you know, or Bhima, right? But no, Krishna was the first, right? Because they were dependent on Krishna as the Lord, right? It means Bhishma blows and then the other warriors blow. That's standard. But here, Krishna blows. He's the charioteer. Why would the charioteer blow the conch shell first? Right? But because he's the Lord. At the same time, as we can see, is that the Pandavas weren't blowing at first because they were hoping that there'd be some conciliation. They'd work something out. Even at this stage, they were hoping that Duryodhana would come to his senses and understand why kill all these people for something unjust. Right? Dhritarashtra was hoping that the same thing, but the Pandavas would give up everything and just go to the forest. Right? And the Pandavas are thinking, why won't they just be just and give us half the kingdom? They should give the whole kingdom, but okay, half, we'll settle. Like that. So they're hoping that. But because they're devotees, when Krishna blew his conch shell, then they blew theirs. Right? Does that make sense? So the others are blowing their conch shells to fight, to support Duryodhana, but they're blowing their conch shells because Krishna blew his conch shell.
We can apply this to many battles through a perception in our lives, in the sense that when we can see Krishna in a situation, then we should act. And until when we're acting from an emotional platform only, it seems like us blowing our conch shells first. But then when we can see the situation in relation to us being servants, then it's like you see Krishna and then you can act, so therefore the result will not be based on our conditioned nature. The way
yes. Yes, yes. Because the idea is that we're not the conditioned nature is being engaged, but it shouldn't be the prominent element. Right? Neophyte means it is the prominent element. Of course, Krishna is more prominent. You know, on the spiritual platform, Krishna is the most prominent. But on the material platform, then your conditioned nature is the most prominent. Right? So, and the attachment to it, one's still working with it, because one appreciates the experiences and the gains that one gets from engaging with it. But it's connected to Krishna. So, therefore, it's perfect. Right? So on the spiritual platform, you have perfect, more perfect, most perfect. Right? So the neophyte stage is perfect, but it's still there's more perfect than that. So the madhyam is still one's working with the conditioned nature, but it's not the drive of the conditioned nature, the need for that experiences or the need for those results. It's just that since it's the conditioned nature, it's easier to work with. Right? I mean, that's what you have. It's easier to work with what you have than endeavor for something you don't have. Does that make sense? Right? So that's better than that is you're simply looking at serving Krishna, and since the conditioned nature is what you have to serve Krishna, that's what you use. So that we see with the Pandavas, is that they're servants of Krishna, Krishna blew his conch, therefore then they're blowing theirs. So because they're Kshatriyas, this is what service they can do. Krishna wants to battle, so they can do this. So if you want to see Krishna in what you're doing, then yes, that'll make it there. Same time as things that are services to Krishna, you know, that are standard practice, that you're regularly doing, even if you're emotional and don't necessarily see Krishna in it, one can still go ahead with those activities. Right? But if it's, you know, endeavoring in some way that would be, you could say, more the platform, the conditioned nature, in that you should see that Krishna is involved before you get too emotionally committed. Does that make sense? In other words, sadhana, we go away, because sometimes sadhana, we're absorbed, we're not absorbed, but that's why it's practice. You just keep doing it by habit, you do it. You know, even when we're not inclined, you still chant your rounds, you still, because you associate with Krishna, one will be purified. But when it comes to the other part of, it means if ashram includes family life, right, or elements of, you know, specific, or occupation, you know, or specifics of one's conditioned nature, you know, in the way of, you know, desires or other things, then in that you should see that Krishna is connected before being so committed. One may be doing things out of habit, but if you're aware of it, then you should include Krishna. Because if you don't, then, you know, it won't go well for you. And one should be endeavoring to become more conscious of these elements that are not sadhana and see that they're connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? Because sadhana, that's universal. That's for the soul. Anyone can do it. Right? It doesn't matter the culture, the background, the position. Everyone can chant japa, go to Mangalarti, worship Tulsi, Guru Puja, Bhagavata. Everyone can do that. Because that's the platform of the soul. That's the Bhagavata platform. But when you're dropping, and even the Pancharatric platform, then there are elements built in to purify you so you are of the standard. That's why there's Manasa Puja and the Achman and Guru, all these different things before Puja, to ensure the consciousness is elevated to that. But when you're dealing with anything that's within the Vedic realm, you know, your family life, economics, you know, anything else like this, sense gratification, liberation, then you must see that Krishna is involved. Otherwise, then, you know, it's not very beneficial, you know, especially if one comes from a culture where, you know, the default setting is impious rather than, you know, following the Vedic literatures. Does that make sense? Okay? So we can distinguish. In ashram, you have two parts, the sadhana and the family life, you know, so like that. And then with the family life, then there's generally some variety of occupation, right? Does that make sense? Now, if it's done for Krishna, a connection there, it becomes service. You know? But otherwise, it's there because there's family. Occupation is there only because there's family. There's no family, there is no occupation. Brahmacharis have no family, so there's no occupation. It's the same activities are simply service. It's part of their sadhana. Does that make sense? So that's why in the Brahminical field, then the how do you say the element of brahmacharya and sannyas, there is no varna aspect. You know what I'm saying? Technically, as far as occupation, they may have the nature, but it's not as far as occupation technically. And even if you have brahminical, where they're involved in deity worship or preaching, then technically it's service, though it's because they're doing that their family is being maintained. Does that make sense? So, therefore, we can see from that, technically, then Prabhupada established 5 out of 8 positions of varnashram. Right? All the aspects of ashram and the brahminical occupation of varna. Because the brahminical occupation is no different from the ashram occupation. It's not different. It's different for kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras, but it's not different for brahmins. Because all the things defined in ashram dharma, which includes sadhana, that is their service.
So everything becomes direct.
Basically. But there are elements that will become indirect as it starts to take on the needs of your conditioned nature that aren't specifically connected. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, things like that. That's another thing. You know, that the hair is washed, you know, before doing puja. That's just part of the Pancharatric system. But that you maybe, you know, dye the hair or something. You put henna in it and make it orange or something because you don't want people to see the gray hairs. Then that is a consideration within the Vedic, not within the Pancharatric. Pancharatric doesn't have scope for that. It's just deity worship. Bhagavat doesn't have scope for that. So that would be the Vedic. You understand? So when it steps out of these two, then it becomes. Does that make sense? Yes.
We can see your descriptions of different signs. How is it important? How
different signs, like
signs of victory.
Yeah. Oh, signs of victory. Okay, not you know, Warsaw, 50 kilometers or something.
How important for the devotees is to understand and see the signs of nature around?
How important is it for the devotees to see the signs like that? I mean, like in a teacup or something, or like that. You know? How the cauliflower and the cheese and the peas fall on your plate, and then, you know.
Like Parikshit Maharaj, when Lord Krishna passed, so the signs of Kali.
He means like omens. Omens. It's not so important. The point is that you look at the opportunity and see how Krishna is involved. Signs only show you what is the situation. They don't tell you what to do or what you will do with it. See, people make a misunderstanding that predestiny tells you what you're going to do. Predestiny only is the situation you'll find yourself in. That's all. Does that make sense? It's just like you come down the stairs, you know, from your house and you come into the living room. That's predestiny, because there is no other path from upstairs downstairs. It comes out in the living room. Now, once you get there, you can either sit there in the living room, turn around and walk back upstairs, go into the kitchen, go into the bathroom, walk out the front door, walk out the back door. You know what I'm saying? But the situation, that's fixed. What you do with it, that's your free will. You know what I'm saying? So the signs will only show you what the situation is or going to be. That's all it's doing. So you can read those, nice. You know, but if you can't read them, don't worry about it. Because as long as whatever the situation appears, you engage it, connect it to Krishna. Then what's the problem? You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise people read into so many things and do nothing. See, reading the signs and doing nothing is a waste of time. Because what do you do with the situation? What if there's a situation, what's supposed to happen?
Service.
And then what will be the result?
Krishna's pleased.
Yes, Krishna's pleased. So Sambandha Abhideva. The situation is Sambandha. It's just part of the field. It's an aspect of the field. Right? That's why then when you study the field, it's not, there is the field, but then there's what you can do with the field. What's the purpose of the field? Right? The kitchen is a field. What's the purpose of a kitchen? You can cook. But so then if you become inspired to cook, then what's the result? You have something cooked. Right? So that's the thing. That's the situation. Does that make sense? But the point is now you can cook for Krishna or cook for yourself. Or decide not to cook. You know, decide to get a box of cereal. But still, it's in the kitchen. Does that make sense? So like that. One has to be very, very careful about all these different sciences, these occult sciences and all that, because very much people give it more credit than it's due. It only defines the situation. Now, you define it, don't do anything with it. That's a waste of time. So why see the situation if you're not going to do it? To be able to walk in, you've studied about kitchens. You walk into the kitchen. While you're in the kitchen, you can point out, okay, here's the stove, here's the oven, here's the pot, here's the garbage disposal, right? You know, here's the, you know, the dog's bowl, you know, all these different things. Great. Now what? So now you can pride yourself. Yes, I can tell all the signs of the kitchen. You know, I can tell. You know, over there, see this little black sooty thing? That's because when the cooking's there, then the smoke off that comes up like that. So that also means that, you know, the gas ratio of the air to gas is not quite right, so it's creating some soot. So what? Now what? You're going to do something? No. He's just proud that he can see the omens. This is much of the time the mistake the devotees make when they go into these fields. They learn all these things and sit there and do nothing.
So here we can see that the signs of victory predicted that the ascetics later said they are already killed.
They are?
Already killed by Krishna.
Yes, but the point is do they, because they're already killed, do the Pandavas sit back and go, hey, we don't have to do anything. Cool. You know, that's what I mean. Right? What do they do?
Fight.
They fight. That's the point. Signs are only to help you identify the situation, right? Astronomy shows you the position of the planet. They have an influence on the situation. They tell you what is the situation, right? The birth chart simply shows you what are the situations you'll be in, right? The omens simply tell you what's coming up right now in the situation, you know? That's all. You know, your prashna is then on the situation you're in, it's defining, you know, making it clear the nature of the position, of the situation. You don't fully understand it. You want to know more about it. But if it says, oh yes, you know, this situation, it'll be very great and it'll be expand and be very nice, but you have to do it. Just like Krishna said, I've already killed them. So that will be the result, but results are only gained through endeavor. You know what I'm saying? Yes.
Does that mean, like, if it says that this will be the situation and you don't perform the necessary action, then that situation won't happen?
Means you won't get any result in the future of that. Whatever is supposed to happen will go on, but you'll get nothing in the future.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that. So the point is since your living is consistent, your endeavor has to be consistent. Otherwise, there'll be no results, right? If every day you work, every day you have something to eat, you stop working, then after some days, you're going to have nothing to eat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the point is your duty is to work. What you're getting now, because what you have, that's the situation. So the situations will keep coming based on your previous work. But what you do now determines what you get in the future. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's so like that. So it's an overlap there. These two things happen at once. One has to be able to appreciate that one has to work. That's what the Vedas are telling us. It's through work then things are gained. Right? Does that make sense? Through endeavor.
Yes.
Prabhupada's always talking about through endeavor. Right? But we're not interested in endeavor for fruit of result. So that's why it's different than karma. Mm-hmm. You know, the karmis are saying give up fruit of work. So the jnanis think that means do no work. No, we mean give up the fruit of mentality. Continue the same work, give up the fruit of mentality. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. The fact that the Pandavas did not sound their conchos first shows that they would prefer to have settled the conflict by conciliation. But when they were challenged, they accepted the fight. Arjuna and Bhima, particularly, were so eager that they even broke the etiquette and blew their conchos before Yudhishthira. The devotees should be ready to fight when the Lord desires so. Right, because Krishna blew, it should be Yudhishthira blows next. But Bhima and Arjuna are so enthusiastic that they blew their conchos. Right? And then after that, Yudhishthira. And then Nakula and Sahadeva. You know, but no one's worried because, you know, it's all for Yudhishthira's benefit. Verses 21 to 26. Arjuna confronted with his attachments. Right, so now it will become obvious. About the material considerations, right? This is where one could say the conditioned nature then makes itself, you know, overly prominent, right? Though we understand this is being arranged by Yoga Maya because Arjuna doesn't have a conditioned nature, right? He's eternally Arjuna, you know, and serving with Krishna. So this is just arranged so that we can get some benefit. So then within his pastime, he serves as, you know, in the relationship of friendship, you know, in the Kshatriya environment. Right? That's his rasa. But because conditioned nature is a reflection of original rasas, you know, the principles of original rasas, therefore you can apply the same principle of God consciousness onto them. And you'll get the same kind of same result as you would in dealing according to one's rasa. Does that make sense? Yes? No. Why not? Mother Yashoda is, her relationship with Krishna is as a parent. Therefore, she has the form of a parent and the environment of a parent. Right? There's a house. Right? And so in that house, she feeds Krishna, takes care, does everything. This material world, the reflection of that, then you have mothers. They have kids. They have houses. They have facility and all that. It's the same duties. The occupation is the same. Right? But now, the difference is that they're the conscious of Krishna. Here, they're not. So the principle is being conscious of Krishna. The principle is not, well, Krishna is her son, and here they're not. No, the principle is she's conscious of Krishna. She's just fortunate Krishna happens to be her son. Right? Does that make sense? But that doesn't mean that in the material world, that the same principle of a mother being God conscious in relationship to dealing with her children can't be attained. Therefore, her conditioned nature can get her the same results as Mother Yashoda's natural rasa will. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, that's the mother's relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. No. So you're dealing with two things at once here. There, the nature and their rasa is the same, right? And the service rendered, it's all one package, it's clear. But here, the nature of the soul, the conditioning that's there, are two different things. But the principle is the same. Servant of Krishna, serve Krishna. So, the soul is acting on the principle of serving Krishna. And then they use the conditioned nature to do that. So that the conditioned nature is used according to what would be the original form. Right? Doesn't make sense. But the in principle, so that's a detail here, but the principle is that the devotee is engaged his nature in Krishna's service. So in this case, the nature happens to be the conditioned nature. But ultimate nature is servant. So he's engaging his nature in Krishna's service as a servant. And the detail is his conditioned nature. Right? Well, in the spiritual world, everyone's engaged in Krishna's service. That's the nature. The specifics is then what is the rasa. So it's the same thing. Just there, it's consistent. There's no difference between the soul and the form that they take. Well, here, there is. So because there's a difference here, then, but that doesn't mean it's not dealt with. But it's dealt with on the original methods that are given. Does that make sense? Right? Yes?
Arjuna doesn't have a conditioned nature. So
Arjuna doesn't have, no.
Is he a jiva or is he Krishna? Or?
No, he's a jiva.
Okay.
But that's his relationship with Krishna. He's always Arjuna.
Okay. Means he never becomes conditioned?
No. Okay. Yeah, that's his service. But his service is within the material world. So Arjuna is only within the material world. You know what I'm saying? So like that, like Kiradaksha Vishnu is not manifest in the spiritual world. He manifests in the material world, the material sphere. So in the same way as Arjuna, he's only manifest within the material pastimes. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's his nature. Yes?
Where do the devotees like Arjuna who service in the material world, where do they go when the material world is wound up? Is there...
They'll be with the Lord because the Lord's always there. So, have to see Mahavishnu, because he has all his associates. Okay. See, as you also have, you have a living entity who goes farther back. You know what I'm saying? So then you have the element that if this is not manifest, just like Hiranyagarbha and the super soul aren't manifest when Mahavishnu breathes in. But it's not that they're not him, because it's the element of creation and maintenance and destruction. But he's Vishnu, so there is no creation, maintenance, and destruction. But on the material creation, you do have that. Right? So that's the added flavor, that's the difference between Vaikuntha and the material manifestation, is that in Vaikuntha, God's mood is, I am God. But in the material world, his mood is, I am the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. Right? Does that make sense? So, Garbhodakshay Vishnu, you know, creates and destroys. Right? And Kirudakshay Vishnu will maintain. You know? Does this make some sense? So these elements will be there. So when they wind up, so then there is somewhere where Arjuna is coming from. Right? Because eventually everything goes back to there's Krishna. And that's it. Then Krishna expands as his Surup Shakti. And so that's complete Godhead with complete energy. Now he expands so many expansions. His potency also expands. And therefore creates the internal, the external, and the jivas. Does that make sense? So everything that there is will have its origin somewhere. Does that make sense? You know, so like that, then they're gone. Does that make sense? Yeah. In a purport to verses 21 and 22, Srila Prabhupada writes, although Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, out of his causeless mercy, he was engaged in the service of his friend. He never fails in his affection for his devotees, and thus he is addressed herein as infallible. As charioteer, he had to carry out the orders of Arjuna, and since he did not hesitate to do so, he is addressed as infallible. Although he had accepted the position of a charioteer for his devotee, his supreme position was not challenged. In all circumstances, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hrishikesha, the Lord of the total senses. The relationship between the Lord and his servitor is very sweet and transcendental. The servitor is always ready to render service to the Lord, and similarly, the Lord is always seeking an opportunity to render some service to the devotee. He takes greater pleasure in his pure devotees, assuming the advantageous position of ordering him than he does in being the giver of orders. Since he is master, everyone is under his orders, and no one is above him to order him. But when he finds that a pure devotee is ordering him, he obtains transcendental pleasure. Although he is the infallible master in all circumstances. Right? So here the infallible, we'll take it that infallible means he always gets done what he's doing, or in fact there's nothing wrong with him. Right? There's no fault. And because there's no fault, he's always accomplishes, you know, what needs to be done. But here is being pointed out, infallible means, yes, this is true, but what's being done is a relationship with the devotees. So he never fails in that relationship. Therefore, he's infallible. Right? Because the point is we do something to get a result. That result becomes part of the field. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is the field is there for what? To interact in a relationship. So Krishna never fails in that. So the dynamic relationship, that's the point. Because the result technically is not the dynamic relationship. You've gotten the result, then it becomes part of the field. The field's not dynamic. You understand? It gives opportunity for more dynamism. But it in itself is not inherently dynamic. That's why when it moves back to Sambandha, one is inspired by that gain. So therefore, one wants to do something with the gain and expand more. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Is that, so it's actual connections with Prajumna. So it's still within the cycle of the dynamic relationship. Right? Because of that mood. your commitment. But factually, it's just another thing in the field. So it's a shankarshan. But because having gained it, you're inspired now to use that. Right? Therefore, it's counted within Prajumna. That makes sense. Yes.
Prajumna means inspirational.
It would be the inspirational aspect of the relationship. Because if you're not inspired, you do nothing. You have a relationship, you're not inspired, you don't do anything. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I've heard once, but I'd like to double check this is correct, that actually the ways the chariots were made in Vedic time, that the Kshatriya actually had his feet on the driver's shoulder. That's how he would tell him how he, you know, that they were much bigger than what we see in the. I think it comes from the lecture, therefore that's why the position of charioteer was like really subordinate, because you didn't have the feet of
the
master.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Because you never really see it in any pictures or drawings like that. I haven't seen it. You'd have to see. You'd probably basically have to look in the Tarva Veda under, you know, making of chariots, and then see, maybe it'll explain. But you do see in some older pictures that the charioteer's seat is lower than the kshatriya's. While in a lot of them, it's, you know, the ones that we see, it means that more recent ones, you don't see that.
That's how we would indicate them right to.
Same time as they also know, because the point is you've challenged a particular kshatriya. You don't just fight indiscriminately. You've challenged someone. So therefore, the charioteer has to know what will be the best position for the kshatriya to fight from with that person. So therefore, he'll... And as you want to go right, but, you know, there happens to be a dead elephant there, right? You know, so then you have to go left to go around the elephant. You know what I'm saying? So it's not exactly... The charioteer, that's why they're special. A sutta is what? What's the sutta? What's their background? And Brahman. So that means they have that spirit, but they have the brains. You understand?
Charities
were children of Kshatriyas and Brahmins? Yes. If a Kshatriya man marries a Brahmin woman, it's pratiloma, so it's against the grain. Right? If a Brahmin man marries a Kshatriya woman, you get a Kshatriya. Right, as a general rule. Sometimes there may be more elephant, but others not. If a Kshatriya marries a Brahmin, you get a Sutta. Right? Now that Sutta may take the occupation of a Brahmin. If it's more Brahminic, you see like Romaharshana Sutta, you know, Ugra Shravash Sutta, so that was that nature. Or you see they take the nature of Kshatriyas, you know, like Yayati's sons, the three sons from Damayanti. So they took up the nature of Kshatriyas. Or they may take up the position of the charioteer, as we see, you know, what's it? Karna and that family he's from, right? That's there. Or if it's really, you know, improper, you know, the consciousness and everything, then they might be someone who traps small animals. You know, they use little snares and catch small animals. You know, that's... So they have basically these four occupations, depending upon, you know, what's the consciousness. Now, once they become suttas, suttas marry suttas, and then they have more suttas. So it's not that they're directly, they are... sons of a Kshatriya and a Brahmin. So they may be, or it may be generations back since that happened. But generally, suttas will marry suttas. Does that make sense? Charioteers are called, in the Vedic culture, are called mechanics. Because they build the chariots. They build them, they know how to drive, so they know all the mechanics of how to make things work. Like that. So he's infallible in all circumstances. So it does mean that what he thinks happens, you know, whatever he endeavors to accomplish, then comes to pass. You know, so that is there. But the element Prabhupada brings out is the infallibleness is that the relationship is always there. Relationship is always the same. It's consistent. So he's always there for that relationship. Right? So, okay. So we clear in the chariot? Like that. So they know how to do, because they can go out. Means someone like Daruka, like Krishna's charioteer, he can go out on the battlefield and himself with the empty chariot go out and destroy armies. Because he knows how to drive them and hit them and, you know, kill everything. Because he can make them fly, he can do all kinds of stuff with them. But the point is that's not how the charioteers work. The kshatriya does that. But if the kshatriya is killed on the battlefield, depending on the situation, you might find they do that or not. They won't bother other kshatriyas, but they'll wipe out their army. Like that. But it's only ones like Daruka or Makali that can do things like that. So you don't hear about it much. You know, otherwise, then why did Karna run into trouble in fighting with Arjuna? He got stuck in the mud. But why did he get stuck in the mud?
His charioteer betrayed him.
Aha. Is that any other perspective on the charioteer?
He got cursed,
of course, so that would happen. But anything else?
The driver made a wrong turn.
Yes, the driver made a wrong turn. Who is the driver? No, Karna. When he got stuck in the mud, Karna was having to fight and drive the chariot himself because Shalya left. Because Shalya said, see, Shalya was a comparable driver on one level to Krishna. And so Duryodhana arranged that Shalya would be the chariot driver for Karna. Because he's thinking, okay, Karna, Arjuna, Shalya, Krishna. So then you have an equal match here. Does that make sense? So now Karna is telling Shalya what to do. But Shalya is more expert in how to position the chariot to fight than Karna is. So his point is, I'll drive the chariot as long as you don't tell me what to do. You understand? So then one might doubt whether the feet are on the shoulders. You know? And even if they were, his point is, you may say turn right, but I know it's better to turn left, so you go with that. So whether it is or not, so it just brings up the elements that the charioteers can be so qualified, they know the better situation to be fighting in. That's why you should have a charioteer that's matched. So for Arjuna's fighting ability, that's why it was seen Krishna's the only one that could drive the chariot. Others wouldn't know enough. You know, unless of course you got Matali or something. But still Krishna will be better. Does that make sense? So it's not, that's why these things, we can't get too attracted by them. Because then they take something into a completely different thing. I mean, oh, the servant, yeah, underfoot and this and that. And it distracts from what it is. Vidura, as the prime minister of Dhritarashtra, is still a Shudra. And he's still a servant. But His capacity as servant is so great, he can serve as a prime minister, but it's still as a servant. Well, if that was a Brahmin, he's superior. You understand? So you have these subtleties within the Vedic system that unless the subtleties are appreciated, it won't be understood. Otherwise, how is it he's a prime minister? He's still a Shudra. But he has the qualifications to do it. And he does it out of service to the king. You know what I'm saying? Well, the Brahmin position, of course, your service to the king, and service to the king, but he's doing it because this is the Shastric position, that a Brahmin doing this kind of, having this knowledge and doing this kind of activity, then they would, this their duty to direct the king properly and to see the proper running of the kingdom. But then that's coming from the Brahminical platform. You know, if it's a Kshatriya, then they're doing like Bhishma will be doing, then it's coming from the Kshatriya platform.
If Vidura is a Shudra, but he has the quality to do his work, which is that a Brahmana will do, why is he not considered a Brahmana if he has the qualification of Brahmana like that?
Because he's still acting within the social system, so you'll act according to the conditioned nature. Right? His wife will also be, his wife will be a Shudrani. Right? So Bhishma was very careful to find a very qualified Shudrani to marry him. Right? And so, you know, he still has the family relations and still the position and everything like that. Does that make sense? Now, if he went to the forest and took up just living in the forest and devotional activity, there he may be considered as a Brahmin as opposed to as a Kshatriya living in the forest. Like when Pandavas go to the forest, they're Kshatriyas living in the forest. But if he went to the forest, he would probably be classified as a Brahmin. Does that make sense? Also, you have the element that he is Yamaraj, so that is a Kshatriya position.
What I don't understand is that, like, if somebody is born as a Shudra, for example, but he shows the qualification of another Vajna, then he should be accepted as that Vajna. That's my understanding. Is that
he should, as long as it's complete in that. Uh-huh. But here, socially, he was comfortable with the position of a Shudra.
Oh, okay.
But occupationally, he could do the duty of a prime minister. But he was doing it as a Shudra assists a Kshatriya. You know what I'm saying? But here we're talking about Brahminical in this case, meaning Brahminical, you know, in ashram and varna. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that's why you have to see is that someone lives a lifestyle that's not Brahminical, but, you know, does puja and this and that, then, you know, that's okay within the devotional environment, but he'll only get what he should get from that. You know, the temple will give you a place to stay in Prashad and a little this and that, and that's it. But because his lifestyle is not Brahminical, he may want more than that. So he'll try through Brahminical methods to get more money, but that's wrong. So that's why then they shouldn't do it. So they say Brahminical, it means it's a package. You know, because a Brahmin means his Varna and Ashram are Brahminical. Right, we don't mean it. He's Brahmin by one thing and not by the other. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that he wasn't, but he's comfortable in that. So he's not having a problem. He lives in the palace anyway. You know, so he's not independent. You know, so whatever they arrange for him, whatever they do, he's comfortable with that. Is that okay? Okay. In his purport to Bhagavad Gita 6:34, Srila Prabhupada quotes an analogy from the Upanishads. In the Vedic literature, Katha Upanishad 1:3-4, it is said, quote, "The individual is the passenger in the car of the material body, and intelligence is the driver. Mind is the driving instrument, and the senses are the horses. The self is thus the enjoyer or sufferer in the association of the mind and senses. So it is understood by great thinkers." Bhagavad Gita 6:34 purport. Okay. Arjuna represents the living entity and Krishna is the intelligence. Bhagavad Gita 7:10. The Lord blesses his devotee with a proper understanding by which he can achieve him. Bhagavad Gita 10:10. The chariot is the body awarded by the demigods according to the law of karma. Arjuna received his chariot from the demigod Agni. The white horses symbolize the purified senses. Unless all senses are under control, there is every chance of fall down. As a strong wind sweeps away a boat in the water, even one of the roaming senses on which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. Arjuna did not rush blindly into the fight. He first wanted to see the enemies and estimate their strength. Okay, so here is that. In other words, we see as the driver is the intelligence, the reins are the mind, and the mind are connected to the horses or the senses. So that means when this intelligence, right, controls the mind, that controls the senses. But if you let go of the reins, you know, or in other words, the intelligence does not control the mind, then the mind, the senses just go whatever they like. Right? So, you know, so this point is being made here that, you know, Krishna's intelligence, the chariot, which is the body, that was given by Agni. You know, so the demigods award the body, so the demigod awarded the chariot to Arjuna. So then you can make this comparison. But so the point is the intelligence must be in control. Therefore, buddhi yoga. Because if it's not buddhi or intelligence, then the problem comes up is that it'll just be the mind, and the mind is just connected to the senses. So what experience you can get out of something is all that will be considered. But the intelligence considers beyond the experience. You may get the nice experience, but then right after that, it may not be so nice. Right? You know, it's like jumping out of a 20-story building. It may be exhilarating, you know, on the way down, but then at some point it kind of abruptly ends. You know, so that experience. So therefore the intelligence considers, okay, for, you know, 10 seconds, it may not be a great idea. You know? Does that make sense? So that way, then you jump out of the, off the top of the building with a large rubber band tied around your feet, right? You know, so then. Not saying that's intelligent either, but it's more intelligent than jumping without the rubber band.
Is it also correct to understand that if the intelligence wants to control the senses, it has to be through using the mind like that?
Through using the mind. Well, the point is the intelligence is driving the horses, right?
Right.
Right, because intelligence is the master of the senses, right? But how does it do it?
Through the mind.
Through the mind. So that means you have to deal with the mind in such a way that you actually get the engagement of the senses that you need. Mm-hmm. But still, the intelligence is the one who is dealing.
Right.
So it's still that masculine feminine principle. The mind's intelligence. I mean, the intelligence is masculine. The mind is feminine. Right, so the intelligence controls the mind, but according in a way that it actually gets the work done.
On the mind's terms.
Yeah, in the terms of the mind. You pull on this one, the horses go this way. You pull on that one, the horses go that way. You can't pull on this one and say why they're not going this way. I'm the master here. I pull on the reins how I want, and they do whatever I want. That doesn't work like that. Like that. Except when you're sitting in a pub with your friends, then it seems to work like that. At least in the discussions. The theory seems to work like that. But unfortunately, when they walk in the front door of the house, all that theory seems to evaporate. Yes? No? Okay. Arjuna did not rush blindly into the fight. First he wanted to see the enemies and to estimate their strength. In the same way, in the beginning of a spiritual quest, the devotee should be able to recognize the real enemies of the soul, kam, krodh, lobh, and should know how to defeat them. In other words, this is the point, you have to know what is there. Not that by knowing, then it's okay. This is the problem. Well, if I don't know, then I can fight it, and if I do know, then you know, it's okay, what's the big deal? We don't want to be fanatic. No, you have to know what's there. How much, you know, kam, krodh, lobh, what else is there? then there's moha, matsarja, missing one.
Mada?
Mada, yeah, madness.
Maya.
Maya, fear.
Maya.
Oh, okay. We have a lot of them, I can say. So, Raghunath Das, when he starts off in the Manasiksha, that's the first thing he starts with, basically. After he's offered his respects to the devotees, is that you have all these enemies that one has to control. Right? So, unless one knows that, then how one's going to defeat them. Right? So, by connecting everything to Krishna, it leaves no room for illusion. Right, if there's no illusion, then these other elements don't come up. Krishna, the Lord of the senses, obeyed the order of Arjuna and drove the chariot amidst the two armies. In verse 24, Arjuna is called Gudakesha, one who conquers sleep. This implies that active persons are more receptive for the Lord's guidance. Or as Srila Prabhupada says, God helps those who help themselves. Right? So we see here's activity is again brought out. You have to be active. Yeah, so Arjuna is one who conquers sleep. So that means even his sleep is connected to Krishna. Right? He is conscious of Krishna even in his sleep. Doesn't mean that the body doesn't rest, but he doesn't stop being Krishna conscious. That's why we say 24 hours a day. Right? So that means, even then, they're dreaming about Krishna, thinking about Krishna, absorbed in Krishna. Well, yes?
How is that possible?
How is it possible? Okay, let us say you're really worried about something in the day. You know, trying to work something out and getting something done and something like that. At night, it doesn't come up in your time when you're resting.
My dream is not so far
off. That's the dream, but there's a state before that. You know, you're not thinking of those things because the body's resting, right? Yes, no, yes. So it's just that if Krishna is the most important thing to you, you just think about him. Right? Yes? No? That's another thing. That's good. As long as you wake up also like that. Give an example. Let's say someone, a famous example would be Jayadwaita Maharaj. So he'd be sitting in the class. And by all indications, it would appear he was sleeping. Because he would be doing like everyone else is doing, and, you know, like that kind of like dozing off. And so then, many a time, because he was considered like, you know, a big pundit and like this, then many a time, you know, other you know, sadhus and big personalities, you know, especially the sannyasis and all that, they would kind of take delight in, ah, now we've caught him asleep. And so they would ask a question to him, right? And, you know, while he's down like this, they'd ask a question, and then he'd come up like this saying what it was. So the body is basically asleep, but he was fully conscious of the class. But it's possible. The point is you practice Krishna consciousness. So in other words, for him, the body's tired, but for him, knowledge in the class is important. Therefore, he's still conscious. You know, while the guy next to him, he's tired, and the class is not so important. Therefore, he hits the ground with a thud, and everyone turns around a lot. Okay. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the difference, because it's valuable to him, therefore he doesn't lose consciousness, though the body is resting. Does that make sense? So that's the, so therefore, at least in this case, Gudakesha.
It's the need for most devotees to happen that would relevant this case.
Whenever it happens, whenever Krishna is important to you, attachment that naturally means there's going to be, you know, more absorption in Krishna. Ruchi, there's going to be... Basically, things start to get dynamic from ruchi, you could say. you know, really quick. It said, Vishwanath says that when one comes to the clearing stage, then the offenses are like blown away like leaves, dry leaves in a storm. But, you know, once you have a taste, then it's dynamic like that. Does that make sense? So, you know. So, clearing, it'll start from nishta. But if you continue at nishta, then you get a taste. Right? Because nishta means then the anarthas are not so prominent. So they're not getting in the way of your chanting, but it won't be as dynamic as is the positive of your taste for the holy name. You understand? Before that, there's no taste and the anarthas are getting in the way. So nishta means the anarthas aren't getting in the way, but there's not necessarily a taste. So when that improves, then there's a taste, then it gets very, very fast. But still, nishta is fast compared to, you know, the neophyte stage. Because always these things, it's the consciousness and the position of it, not necessarily just the formal stage. You know what I'm saying? Because anartha nivriti, you know, having accomplished anartha nivriti is known as nishta. Right? Because you've gotten rid of the anarthas that are getting in the way of your being fixed in devotional service. Right? But there's also the element that anartha nivriti means the stage of bhava, because you've gotten rid of the anartha of the conditioned nature. You know what I'm saying? So therefore bhava can be called anartha nivriti also. That's the thing, is that they have these levels. Does that make sense? But still, even bhava, there's still, until one perfects that, it's only a prema, then you could say, now this is, yeah, solid.
The nishta can be anartha nivritti, because that's when the anarthas are gone.
It's not the stage of having conquered.
Okay.
But you have anartha nivritti when you're dynamically trying to take care of. These will come up in the nectar devotion class.
Okay.
It is significant that Krishna poised the chariot just in front of Bhishma and Drona, the persons for whom Arjuna had strongest affection. Thus Arjuna was confronted with his most powerful material attachments. Right? It's a huge, you've got 11 Akshahini, you've got millions of people out there. So he could have drove the chariot anywhere, but he drove right up in front of Bhishma and Drona. Right? So that's... When one wants to surrender, Krishna reveals to him what his weaknesses are and how to overcome them. Then it is up to the devotee to take advantage or to develop his dormant Krishna consciousness. In other words, being aware of what one's attachments are, that's not, many will make the mistake of that, oh, I'm going backwards in devotional service. No, this is you're becoming aware of the field. Before that, you are not aware of the field, but very enthusiastic. Right? Because many times in enthusiasm, you're not aware of what's around you. It's just so nice and everything. So as one matures, one becomes aware of what the attachments are. But that doesn't mean that one now doesn't deal with them. Because when you're made aware of them, you're also made aware of how to get rid of them. It's just whether you're willing to get rid of them. That's all. Do what it takes to get rid of them. Right? Because if somebody's doing something wrong, they're attacked, then you ask them, well it means in an ideal scenario, what should someone do? They could tell you like that. So then you do it, oh no, but it's so difficult, it's so, that, you know, it'll immediately go back into the mind. But, you know, for that moment, the intelligence comes out and very clearly says what to do. So the attachment is revealed and the method to get rid of it is revealed. But now it's up to us, like Arjuna, now to do something with it. Or, like Arjuna in this case, to become overwhelmed by it. So it's through the knowledge of the Gita, then we can get past that being overwhelmed by the anartha that we just figured out we have. Yes?
So it would be very useful for us to understand how to do this process of dealing with this. As I said, we can immediately know, oh, we should do this. But this is
the distance is only, the distance is our enthusiasm to apply it. That's all. Like, is chanting Hare Krishna difficult? Can anyone do it? So, what keeps some people from chanting? Their unwillingness. So it's not that the chanting's hard. Oh, it's so hard to chant. No, it's not hard to chant. You talk all day. It's the same thing. It's just what words you use, you know? You know? And that these words you've gotten in Parampara, of course. But you know what I'm saying? So it's not difficult, but it's they're unwilling to. That's why until Prajumna is in place, no action happens, because you're not willing. Then when you're willing, then you start to look at it in a dynamic way, and what's the goal, what are the processes, and then you'll do the activity. But just you know the field, then you go, oh, you know, I got this, I got that, oh, this is so mad, how can I do it? You know, but there's no enthusiasm. That's ignorance. You think, oh, I can't this, that. That's ignorance. Right? So the field is in the position of ignorance, because it's the dead matter that you're going to deal with. So if you identify with the dead matter, then ignorance is dominant. Right? You identify, I'm servant of Krishna, I engage this in Krishna's service, then you're dealing on the spiritual platform. Then one's enthusiastic. You understand? So, in other words, the knowledge of the Gita is so one contemplates so that one will develop enthusiasm. As we see, Arjuna is lamenting. Right? And in one sense, you could say he has good cause. Side and the downside of modern technology is you're available at anywhere, which can be good, but at the same time also bad. Okay. So a devotee has to take it up. That's the whole point. Is Arjuna, he's bewildered. He got the knowledge that the Gita applies. From that, he was able to therefore conquer those anxieties and become enthusiastic to take up the fight. Right? So in other words, one is, why are we starting with this Vishada Yoga? Because lamentation, that's the anxiety of being in the material world, the material existence. So then with the knowledge of Gita, we can give up that. We'll be doing the same activities, but now for Krishna. Right? So that's what Gita is giving us, is that now we're doing it for Krishna. It doesn't change the situation. Arjuna didn't change the battle plan, nothing, by being Krishna conscious. This idea is that, oh, it's spiritual, it must be some different mystical thing, you know, now, you know, the chariot rides upside down or something like that, and you know what I'm saying? It's not like that. This comes from the impersonal contamination that we think spiritual has to be different from material. No, material is simply a distorted reflection of the original. Not distorted, perverted. Because in some cases it can be an exact reflection. It's just perverted. Instead of it being Krishna as the center, we make ourselves the center. Right? Does that make sense? So, in other words, everybody has problems in the material world, obstacles, anxieties, due to material attachment. Right? And so this knowledge of Gita can overcome that, and then we continue with that same enthusiasm to serve Krishna. Does it make sense? Right? So it doesn't change. So that's why one may say, well, why do we need this first chapter? You know, oh, there's not much in this chapter. But we can see the whole thing of surrendering to Krishna, taking up that devotional mood, and what are the moods there? It's all it's bringing out. Does that make sense?
Then we see Maharaj, the first chapter is describing the problem and the 17 others is the solution.
Yeah, basically. But then at the end of the 18th, it'll have to give a conclusion. Because you're going to have all three positions. You know, so Arjuna's ready to fight, follow his order, and, you know, then Sanjaya says there'll be all victory. So, you know, Dhritarashtra's happiness was short-lived. You know? In other words, the first chapter of Gita looked pretty good to him. The other, you know, most do then through the half, you know, till the end of the 18th, he's not quite sure. And then the end of the 18th chapter, then it's not looking so good again. You had something?
Yeah. Personalism
or
Christian background.
Yes. But there's a situation. Yeah, okay. But there the utopia is the facilities. And that there's no material anxieties. So they have an understanding that, okay, Vaikuntha has no material anxieties, but their focus is on, they don't mind the material facilities, they just don't want the anxiety, but there's the, you know, the downside of the material things. The inconvenience, yeah, of the material. So, therefore, in that case, heaven is basically a material place that doesn't have any problems. So it's the heavenly planets, right? And, you know, even what you were saying in the kind of Orthodox Judaic tradition, even going to heaven doesn't mean it's a permanent thing. Right? You can come back again. So therefore it's even more close to the concept of the demigods. The only difference is they want to come back, while the guys that are up, once you're up there, they don't want to come back. So there's something got lost in the translation there, you know. So
even in the spiritual world there's anxiety for Krishna.
Yes, anxiety is not a problem. Just like, let us say, you're having some guests over and they're very important to you and you know what to do, but you're in anxiety that everything will be perfect and on time. Is that anxiety bad? No. And then when, you know, everything's ready and the guests come and everything's nice and they're happy, then that it gives rise to the happiness that comes up from it. You know what I'm saying? So the obstacles aren't actually the problem. It's that we perceive them as a problem. You know, let us say, we'll give a very, not necessarily relevant example, you know, but hopefully it'll get the work done. Let us say someone somewhere in the universe is having a bad hair day, okay? And, you know, they're grumpy. So they come out of their house, and then a bunch of kids run by yelling and screaming, and they have to stop at that. Now, what's going to be their reaction?
Angry,
annoyed, and all that. Now, let's say something's happened, and they're on the top of the world, and everything's perfect, and they walk out of the door, and these kids run by. Then what happens? Oh, kids, you know, they're stupid. Yeah, yeah. Right? So, were the kids actually an obstacle? No. We perceive it as one or not. You know, because so that's the point. When we have greater ideals, when we're functioning on our ideals, we're inspired. But when we're just looking at what we have and there's no inspiration, that's where there's anxiety. You know, because the difficulty comes is why that would be there. One, of course, the soul being eternal is looking for eternal happiness. But situation is in the position of sat. Because in the spiritual world, it's sat. In the material world, it's ignorance. So the situation is founded on the principle of sat. So the jiva being eternal, and so in that position, that's where sat is, right? Satchitananda of the soul. So the situation, then they think, is eternal. So it's bad, and it's eternally going to be bad. Everyone else said, no, it's not bad. It's not that big of a deal. No, but you don't understand. Because they're having that feeling. So they're in contact with the eternality of it. Because actually the situation is Krishna. Krishna is eternal. So then they're experiencing that eternalness. And so then they'll think, oh, this is going to be forever. But nothing in the material world is forever. You know. So one can be heartened by no bad situation will last forever. Yeah, but anytime, because it's the emotion, because the intelligence goes that, because intelligence means that there's calculation, there's discrimination, then there's time. So then you can see, oh, this is going to be, you know, for this long or this or that, or if we do this, we can correct it. But the mind is simply experience, and experience means you're in touch with something. You know, what you're actually in touch with is Krishna. So therefore you have that eternal experience. Right? But because you don't see it as Krishna, therefore you don't get the spiritual inspiration. Then you're dealing with the mundane. And mundane is always, what comes out with, basically comes to mind is like boring. But, you know, that in other words, that feeling from boredom is just like there's nothing here. It's empty.
Despair.
Yeah, despair. Vishada yoga. Yeah, okay. Does this make sense? So it's the mind that is there. Because the women will work predominantly more on the mind. The man is supposed to work more on the platform intelligence. But as we pointed out, the intelligence is controlling the activities through the nature of the mind. Right? It means, in other words, the horses are the senses. That means what activities are done. So the intelligence is controlling the activities, but through the mind. So you have to pull on the reins how will be appropriate for what you want to get done. So the problem is most don't. They just either don't bother with the reins or do whatever they like or do too roughly. And then when it doesn't go right, then they want to blame. They want to blame the mind or blame the senses. No, it's just their driving ability is not very good. You know what I'm saying? That's just the way it is. Right? Okay. In order to please Krishna, Arjuna had to give up his attachment for all who were on the wrong side. This test comes in life of every devotee. Devotee who wants to surrender to the Lord will have to give up his selfish desires. If he decides to keep them and to run away from the battle, following the path of least resistance, his progress in Krishna consciousness will be checked. He will be in the position of a person who wants to possess a precious gem but does not want to pay the price for it. So Arjuna, that was Arjuna's first thing. He'll run away. Right? But we see is that one could say, well, isn't that better? And he's like, you know, all this and that. Yes, but what's the position? Why that determination? Right? Why is it better not to fight and not to create problem for anybody and just go and live in the forest? What is the inspiration? Passion for the bodies, yes, okay. That could be something. Avoiding the difficulty. But this avoidance of the difficulty in this case is generated from what mode? Self-endurement. But you could say that would be there. That would be there. So that would be the ignorance. But there's one other one that's very important that we generally miss. Goodness. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Desire for no
problems. Yes, because one of the symptoms of devotional service in the mode of goodness, you want no problems. Right? So it's not that your intelligent work out a way that there's less problems. Your motive is not to have any problems, rather than problems get in the way of the progress of the, of whatever service you're doing. Therefore, removing the problems makes the service go better. You just don't want any problems. So there's a difference there. That's the difference between pure goodness and goodness. Because one is actually connected to Krishna. The other one is you don't want any problems, because that's what liberation means. No problems. Right? No, we endeavor for pure goodness, and at least you fall into goodness. Yeah, you know. So on a bad day, then you fall down to goodness, because goodness is enlightening. It's uplifting. So that's why it's, even though it's mundane, it's a better position. Like that. Does that make sense? It's a better position. Okay. So one has to do so. Arjuna doesn't want to pay for it. But because the Krishna conscious thing is Krishna wants this, therefore he fights. So whatever the obstacle is, that's not the problem. That's what he deals with. But he wants to run away from it because of that. So much of the time we might find that we will say that something's not good because, you know, it's not good on the worldly platform. It's not good for pranamoy. It's not good for anamoy, or it's not good for, vijnanamoy, right, for liberation. Like that. Problems in the material world. Either, you know, we don't want to hurt other people, so that's pranamoy. You know, we know if we do like this, we'll get some problems, so if we go into that, we'll have less problems, so it's anamoy. Right? But it's generally never based on dharma, unfortunately. You know, that this is the nature, so you shouldn't be doing this, you know. In verse 23, Arjuna wants to see the enemies who have come to fight on the side of the evil-minded Dhritarashtra. On seeing them face to face, however, Arjuna shifts his perspective and takes them to be his relatives instead. Thus he feels compassion and lists several reasons why he should not be asked to fight with them. This is an important point, is perspective. Because here you have, he says, let's see who has come to fight. Right? But once he sees who's there, he shifts it from these are the enemies to these are my relatives. Right? So now Arjuna, the Bhagavad Gita shows one how to adjust the perspective so that one can see from the spiritual platform. And the spiritual platform means one is not then dealing with attachments, you know, other than attachments to Krishna. Does this make sense?
So, if we pursue the analogy that, you know, Krishna puts us in front of our, you know, anarthas, our clothing or whatever, is it also that at some point, you know, we should, like, oh, well, this is part of me, or, you know, like...
We shouldn't.
Like doing like Arjuna, oh, this is part of me, or this is why should I...
No, but I don't quite understand the point.
Like in the analogy.
I understand. Now, why are you making the point? You've given the analogy as an example of your point. I didn't quite catch the point.
The question is it that also that when we meet the enemy, we also identify with the...
Yes, that's the problem. Is we like Arjuna here, we shift the focus. So then we change the identity. Here it's I'm a warrior and here are the enemies. So you have the field and there's enemies, right? And so, but then when he got there, he changed it and the field was family. So he's using the wrong perspective. So that's the difficulty, is that in seeing one's anarthas, then one may identify with it, because one identifies with the mind. So to avoid identifying with the mind, then one has... That's why the philosophy is there. Right? So that one can look at it without identifying with it. Because the philosophy is beyond the conditioned nature. So that's why it's used as the tool for doing that. Does that make sense? So that's why we were mentioning before, is we must do this, but we must be aware that once seeing it, we don't identify with it, and therefore say, oh, I'm so bad, and become insecure, or gain confidence, and what's the big deal, we're not fanatic and all that, and then move the other way. Because you see, generally devotees have a tendency to do one of these two. You know, they see their own shortcomings and then they become insecure and they feel that they're useless as devotees and they're not inspired to do anything because they're so useless. Or the others, he's inspired to do things, but it's not necessarily spiritual, because to be at peace with himself that, you know, okay, I have these bad qualities, but, you know, what's the big deal? Everybody has bad qualities and this and that. So he identifies with them, and then where is his enthusiasm? To act in relationship to those anarthas. Not spiritual. So he said, we're not fanatic. That's fine. We're not fanatic. Yeah, we're not. But then the result should be spiritual endeavor. But the result's material endeavor. So therefore you can understand it's not philosophy. They're saying, oh, it's fanatic. It's what we were talking about before. The unscrupulous materialistic mind is using spiritual philosophy to establish its position. You understand? So if the person goes, oh, you know, but he's got all these anarthas, or, you know, he got that. Yeah, what does it matter? We're chanting Hare Krishna. We do our best for Krishna. You know? Then you can understand that's actually understanding we're not fanatic. But not fanatic doesn't mean not committed. Right? Because if the position of not being fanatic was good, then let us propose a position for everyone's contemplation. So if being fanatic is bad and being stuck to one thing is good, why do we see on one level that if it's according to the modern kind of scenario that people are committed to relationships, that's good? Because isn't that fanatic? You know, so it's only if it's Vedic, then you're not so fanatic and committed to it. You know, so then the point is that then committing yourself to a role in a relationship is fanatic. So therefore, if we're really broad-minded, shouldn't we be more liberal and anyone can do anything in any relation as they please? But people immediately say no, because then they get insecure about their relationships. So all it is there's something above or below their standard of relationship that they consider to be wrong or fanatic. Right? If it's below their standard, that's Maya. If it's above the standard, that's fanatic. Because they're both seen as impediments to their own standard and their own identity. Does this make sense? Yes. Three minutes.
You said there.
When you say you said means I did something wrong here.
No.
Okay. I always get worried when someone said you said. What did I say?
It was mentioned that
first
Arjuna thought that he is a
great
warrior, and there are enemies here. And then next, he understand that they are my family. For example, if Arjuna continues thinking, even when they're among these armies, if Arjuna continues thinking that I'm warrior and they're enemies, so let's thank you. I don't care. They're my relatives. And does it mean that with this consciousness, he will commit sinful activities?
Will he commit sinful activities?
Not
looking at it from the spiritual perspective, but going out there as a warrior on the battlefield, will it be sinful? No, because he is acting according to the religious principles of a kshatriya, but it will only be piety. Right? His leaving the battlefield, that will be sinful. But Krishna is giving a third alternative. That is performing those activities that would be considered pious, but without any fruitive desire, right? Because that becomes then Krishna Buddhi Yoga, becomes Krishna conscious. So, in other words, he thinks I am the warrior and I'm the man, so it's a problem, right? But he's confident and willing to do something. Then he thinks, oh, you know, this is not a nice situation. We'll lose everything and the family, and the whole reason for fighting is for the family. So then that's another position. But what Krishna is doing is he's giving the spiritual perspective, but it takes the active role. It still takes the position of proper performance of duties. It's not that, you know, does that make sense? So this is being applied here. There are other examples given in the Upanishads where one sees but there's the higher duty, the spiritual. Right? But the Pandavas also showed that. it was time for Krishna left, then they just went to the, you know, headed to the mountains. That's it. Does that make sense? So you have to know where it applies. So what did Yudhishthira say about when Krishna left? You know, in the Bhagavatam, what was his point about the position of Krishna's relationship to them? He established that because of Krishna, then we had our kingdom, we had our positions, our weapons, our family. Everything was going nice because of Krishna's arrangement. Right? Because this was the basis of interaction. But if Krishna's not there, there's no need of these. Right? Because that was to serve him in that capacity. So now they serve him in this other capacity. So now they leave all that and go to the forest. So as long as someone has that identity and need for these things, then one works with them. But not as Arjuna first came out on the battlefield. Right? But as Arjuna after he's enlightened. So in other words, someone has a need for family environment, but if he just identifies with it and deals with it in that way, it's still going to create problem. Even if he deals in the nicest way and is pious, it's still going to make problem. But if he understands it in connection to Krishna, and but if he says, oh, this is all Maya, and gives it up, like a lot of devotees, they're married, but they don't actually involve themselves and interact. They take no emotional responsibility, and they try to take as minimal spirit, I mean, how you say, physical or material responsibility as possible. But they're very careful about taking care of their own needs of what they, I want to preach, and so I need a computer, I need this, I need that. But, you know, they can't pay the bills for the family. You know what I'm saying? So this is actually Arjuna running away from the battlefield and claiming it's spiritual. Right? So Arjuna is then, so then the point is that it must be seen in connection to Krishna. And therefore, these duties are given by Krishna. Religion comes from Krishna. Right? What is it? Dharma tu sakshat bhagavat panitam. Right? Dharma comes from God. So God's given. This is the way to deal if you have these inclinations. And so then through those inclinations, you can connect that to Krishna and therefore do service to Krishna. Does that make sense? So Arjuna, therefore, is fighting on the battlefield, though originally it was for his kingdom and revenge to Duryodhana, is being done simply as service to Krishna, to please Krishna. Then what results come? They get a kingdom or not? That doesn't matter, because as soon as they get the kingdom, they're not interested. And very soon, everybody starts heading for the forest anyway. Like that. You know, as soon as they get back, then Kunti leaves for the forest. Like that. Dhritarashtra goes to the forest. Vidura goes to the forest. You know, and then a short time later, they go to the forest. So gaining a kingdom and all this and that, that's not the main thing. It's service to Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's a third perspective. So the problem is devotees take one or the other. But when they're taking the one, it's not necessarily based, unless they're, you know, generally Hindus, it's not necessarily based on Dharma. You know, it'll be based on some, you know, modern social concept, which may be based on something pious or may not be. You know, or they run away from it, which is anyway sinful. But Krishna's saying, no, you engage your nature in his service. That's actually the perspective. So when so that's what we'll see in the next chapter, why Arjuna is bewildered. Because Krishna talks spiritual life, and he thinks spiritual life will replace the activities you perform it, because that's the idea. Spiritual means you don't do anything what's here. But Krishna is saying, no, you add spiritual to what you're already doing. That's what makes it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that'll be discussed more in the second chapter. That's the topic there. Okay, so then tomorrow we'll deal with this verses 27 to 46, Arjuna's reasons not to fight. And then we'll give out the essays. Right? Okay? So after the class tomorrow, we'll give out the essays. Like that. Thursday, yes. True. Good point. Good save. time. Srila Prabhupada had a key. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada had a key. Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki. Jai Nitai Gaura Plingananti.